Right. So, if you please, those of you who have smartphones, if you could look up the tiger. If you look at it, look it up with a Y, you will find it. Especially if you put William Blake, but if you just look at it, look for it with a Y, I'm pretty sure you will find it instantly. One of the greatest short poems in the English language, and I hope to be able to communicate that idea to you today. Well, anyway, what do you know about William Blake? Do you know anything about William Blake? Do you know anything about William Blake? He's a poet. He painted, especially he etched and then painted his etchings. Do you understand etch? Lithography art or something like that. And then he painted them. So you have, for example, in the case of the tiger, there are, it's something between 12 and 20 different versions. And they're quite different, actually, the illustrations of the tiger between one and the other. It can be quite interesting to compare the different pictures. And, of course, you can do that on Google Images. Just go and type in the tiger, and you'll see that there, some of the tigers look very gaunt. Some of them look rather cuddly, rather sweet, etc., etc. So it depends. And he is a friend of all of the people who matter at this time, people like Thomas Paine, Mary Wollstonecraft, William Godwin. He illustrated one of Mary Wollstonecraft's books. So he's in the same sort of circle. Not famous during his lifetime. Some people like Wordsworth thought that he was mad. He thought that Wordsworth was a crap poet. He was right, Wordsworth was wrong. But he did have visions and things. So he saw angels and things like this. He certainly, a very sort of spiritual side of things. But at the same time, very sort of modern in the sense. I mean, he's a very, very attractive figure for modern progressives, modern socialists, or whatever. I mean, in the sense that he would, on sunny days, he would go out into his garden with his wife naked, so sort of modern in that sort of sense. But also a lot of these, I can't remember if he was a vegetarian, but a lot of these people were, but hugely bothered about slavery and child labor and all of these types of things. A big social conscience, a Republican, but also somebody with a sort of spiritual side of things. So when his brother Thomas, died, he said he saw his soul leaving his body and believed in spiritualism and angels and this sort of thing after that. And hugely involved in theology, but not conventional theology, not Christian theology. So he invents his own theology around a surprisingly modern understanding of the mind. There's very much the sort of left sphere, right sphere idea of the brain being involved in a rational side and a creative side. And reason or raison is seen as the thing that destroys creativity. And so there's very much this. I mean, for those of you who've enjoyed the TED talk of Robertson, Sir Kenneth Robertson? The one TED talk everybody has seen. No? Not you people. Have you seen any TED Talks? Yes? Have you seen the TED Talk by Sir Kenneth Robertson about does education destroy creativity? Oh. Well, I mean, this is the TED Talk, the most seen TED Talk in history. It's been seen by 8 million people or something like this. It's by far the most popular TED Talk. Something like does our education destroy creativity? And it's by Sir Kenneth Robertson. Robinson. But it's very good. And there's this idea about education being an imposition, a straitjacket, and mucha gente de fuerza, that is placed on children to destroy their imagination, compared to a more liberal sort of Montessori or whatever type idea of encouraging children's imagination, encouraging creativity. It doesn't actually have to be either or. You can develop both types of higher order thinking skills. So you can develop critical thinking and creative thinking. The problem is that education, which is about putting facts into children's minds, magisterio, magistral education, is absolutely a waste of time in a world where you have all of the data in the world in your pocket, on your mobile phones. What you need to do to be able to interpret data, critically think, and think creatively, which computers still can't do. When computers can think creatively, apagai vámonos. But for the moment, that is our great advantage. We can think creatively, they cannot. Yeah? But there's absolutely no point in filling children's minds with facts, because they're walking around with all of the facts. However good a teacher you are, there's no way, even on my most specialist subject, say on The Tempest, there's no way I can have as much information about The Tempest as there is on the machine that you have in front of you. It's just impossible, because that is the sum of human knowledge, if you like, practically, about any particular subject. So that's not what is happening. What should be happening is provoking creative thinking, provoking critical thinking. And that's very, very much part of Blake's thinking. So what he's generally doing is and another thing which is absolutely modern is in symbiotics and in modern concepts of education, is the idea of learning through multiple forms. So if serious learning when I went to university means text, no pictures, and not very many headings, and you're lucky if you get a graph, modern education is much more about combining pictures and videos and graphs and sound recordings and realia, things you can touch. Well, there's now 8 intelligences, theoretically, because there's ecological intelligence. They keep growing the number of intelligences. But yes, doing all of those types of things, not just because there are some people who learn differently from others, some people who learn by acting, some people who learn by touching, some people who learn visually, some people who learn through orally, some people who learn through text, but also because we all learn through all of those things, and some of those things are stronger. But if you are learning through different directions, through different intelligences, the learning is better and stronger for everybody. One of the things that's happening here is that you have text with illustration. But when in the 1990s they would have been saying reinforce the text with the illustration and the infographia and the graphics and this type of thing, somebody like Blake is much more in tune with the 21st century, which is saying contrast the illustration to the text. Give more information in the illustration. It should be related, not completely unrelated, but give another perspective. And so what tends to happen with Blake is you have the picture is related to the text, but says something different from the text. In many cases, in the case of the tiger, the lion is... in many cases, in the case of the tiger is very different from the tiger he is describing in the poem. And that, you could say, he wasn't very good at drawing tigers, yeah? Like, can't draw hands. No. In all of his poems, there is this difference, there is a different type of relationship. There are things that are being suggested in the drawings that... reverberate with what is in the text. So they're two different things. But it goes much further than that. Shut up. It goes much further than that. Education as we have known it, except for somebody of the very youngest ones of you, but most of us have known it, is about learning what is right, etc., etc. Lake is much more about causing you to think about something and not giving you the right answer. Ambiguity is part of the process, but ambiguity is an intentional part of the process because the answer is within you. And this isn't actually something which is particularly new. That's where we get extucare from. Education is leading out. It's not putting in. It's not training. It's education from you, outwards, leading out. So you know everything already, according to Socrates. And it's just a case of the teacher finding the information within you. So what Blake is largely about is about asking questions or provoking questions. Now, in something like infant joy or in infant sorrow, he's provoking questions. In The Tiger, you have a poem which is entirely made up of 12 or so questions. He's not actually asserting anything. He's asking questions to make you think. And the answer is within you, and each of you should have different answers to what this poem is about. And that is why this poem is the most written about piece of short literature in the English language, probably one of the most written about short poems in the world, simply because there is so much interpretation. And there is an area that we can call tiger studies, more or less, that in the way that you might have people who specialize in restoration comedy, what we have here is people who specialize, who do lots of doctoral theses on this one poem, because it's so complex and so enriching. So I hope to be able to communicate some of that to you. So read it, find the, do you have a telephone? You don't have a telephone, don't have a smartphone. Could you find the tiger spelled with a Y, T-Y-G-R-E, and read it? And obviously people out there can do the same. I'm talking to them, not you. You read, I'm talking to them. I will be posting a footnoted version of this text when I get home. But, sorry, I should have done it beforehand. I have to go back into the swing of teaching and posting. And here we are. Tea time. Oh, really? But I'm sure it's cheaper in the Indian shops here. And also, my Indian friend gives me a special price. But they have little boxes. In the cotton list? Right. Because, yeah. My Indian friend has big bags for 10 euros, so it's much better to buy it here than in the cotton list. But it is good that the cotton list does that. But I mean, Mercadona has tattoos, so. Does that mean that tea is becoming more popular instead, or just there's more giddies? Yeah. It's still in the bar, and you can go to a bar and they don't know how to make it. And they give you hot milk. Yeah. No, it's horrible too. Okay, has everybody managed to read the poem? Yes? Talk to me. Yes, Nick. Hi, Nick. Yes? It needs a little bit more reading. Good. Okay, this is probably the best known poem in the English language. British people know incredibly, British and American people, Anglos, know incredibly little poetry. Very little emphasis is given to poetry in schools, much less than probably should be. But if there is one, but I think poetry is a bit more important in Spain. I don't know, anyway. If there is one poem that most British people could recite the first two lines, probably, it is Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forest of the Night, what immortal hand or eye could frame my perfect symmetry. And it is pronounced symmetry in his accent. Obviously, today we would say symmetry, but symmetry, it did rhyme. It's not that he didn't know how to rhyme, it did rhyme at that time. It's an off rhyme, it's a historical rhyme, like you would find in Shakespeare and Darwin. But the other reason that this poem is so popular is that it is taught to six-year-olds. It's a poem about a tiger. What could be better for a six-year-old, yeah? Six-year-olds like tigers. But it is also taught to 12-year-olds. And it is also taught to 16-year-olds. And it could also be taught for people who are doing university entrance exams to study literature. And it is also taught to university students, and it is also a common subject of postgraduate students. So it is a poem that, because it is made up just of questions, it can be taken on every level from children saying, a poem about a tiger, and there's a picture of a tiger, how nice, wonderful. And you can just learn it, and you don't understand anything, but it sounds nice, to hugely sophisticated and possibly ridiculous interpretations. But this poem is directly inviting interpretation, so it's not as ridiculous as some literary theory things where the idea of suggesting that Shakespeare is, for example, showing some advanced understanding of Freudian psychology 300 years before Freud is much more problematic than a poem which is built of questions and is saying the meaning is something that you create meaning, then obviously you can create the meaning you like from it. So that is, it makes more sense. Any reflections before we start looking at it? Anything you notice about it? What about the structure? BB. No. AABB. Symmetry, yeah, symmetry. No. Night bright, AA. I, symmetry, BB. They're rhyming couplets. What type of meter is it? It is not an iron. What is an iron? What is an iron? What is an iron? Buddha, Tiger, Tiger, Benin, right. So they're not I ams. They're not I ams. No? Tiger, it's not Tiger, Tiger, it's Tiger, Tiger. So, who's the meter? Trochees, right. Tiger is a trochee, thank you. So what is the meter? What is the meter, children? Anybody out there, do you want to tell me what the meter is? They won't tell me what the meter is here. How many syllables? Seven. Strange number. Interesting. Seven syllables. So, what is the meter? Hectometer is how many? A syllable is the same as a foot. Who has been teaching you? Me. Is a syllable the same as a foot? What is a foot? Help me, help me. Oh, for them. Yes, thank you, 4 feet. Yes, 4 feet good, 2 feet bad. That's another. Tetrameter. Thank you. Right. So, it is what type of tetrameter? Trochaic tetrameter. What type of trochaic tetrameter? Catalectic trochaic tetrameter. So, it's not your first day. You've been doing this for months. Okay. So, what does catalexis mean? What is catalexis? Children? I'm going to get catalexis, I'm not going to give you a clue. I'm going to tell you the answer because I'm bored. Catalexis means you have lost the last unstressed syllable. Okay? So, it's still trochaic. So, it's still tetrameter, because we have four stressed syllables. Tie, tie, bear, bright. Tie, tie, bear, bright. Tiger, tiger, burning, bright. But it should be, if it was a trochaic tetrameter, it would be tiger, tiger, burning, brighter in the forest of the nighter. No, it's tiger, tiger, burning, bright in the forest of the night. So we've lost the last unstressed syllable. What type of literature would you expect to be written in trochaic tetrameters, either catalectic or not? Machines keep turning themselves off. Stop turning yourself off. Romances, in the Spanish sense or the English sense? Well, we're not talking about Spanish literature, exactly. No. Not in the English sense. Sonnets! No, not sonnets. Sonnets are in iambic pentameters. You know that. You're just trying to provoke me. Somebody? Nobody? Very common. In every meaning of the word common. Exactly. Excellent. Wonderful. Nursery rhymes. Jack be nimble, Jack be quick, Jack jump over the candlestick. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. Good, yes, you will have hundreds, yes, they'll be all over the place. And tiger, tiger, burning bright, it just fits into what your 6-year-olds will be expecting to hear. It sounds right for them. It's also the normal rhyme pattern for ballads. What are ballads? in English, not in Spanish. What are ballads? Lyrical songs. No and no. What are ballads? They can be set to music, but they don't have to be. A ballad, above all, is a popular narrative poem. It is a poem that comes out of the popular tradition. So poems about highwaymen and things like this. It has nothing to do with elevated poetry. It has to do with the popular poetry. Of course, that popular poetry is very, very much what the Romantics and people like Robbie Burns, people like Goethe are interested in. They're interested in the local national tradition of poetry, oral poetry, which tends to be in trochaic tetrameters. What's the difference between a trochaic tetrameter and iambic pentameter? Well, what's the difference? You can say, what's the difference? A syllable, yes, okay. Or a foot. But what's the difference in terms of the sound of the thing? What has less room? Yeah, well, okay, we can talk about less room. Something has less energy. Okay? An iambic pentameter is when we're talking on the stage and we're being serious. We use iambic pentameters for Paradise Lost because we're talking about serious things like God and Satan and things like that. But by reducing 1 foot fewer, it has much more energy. It's da-dum, 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 da-dum. We can sort of riding along on a horse. Right? It's easier to memorize. It's one syllable less, but it's, or one syllable fewer, sorry. But it's also, it's much more energetic. It's much more popular. And it's another reason why it adapts better to song. It doesn't have to be song, ballad, but it can be much more easily. Iambic pentameter is a bit too long for a verse of a song. So, mission statements. Go to hell, neoclassical poetry. Not interested. I'm interested in childhood. I'm interested in popular productions. Not people showing how clever they are because I can write iambic pentameters with quatrains and sextets. Ooh, how clever I am. No. Yeah, and Volta. Oh, look at my Volta. Not that. Why is he interested in children? What's special about children? For the Romantics. No, it's more philosophical than that. Children for a lot of traditional Christians, especially sort of Calvinists and people with no sense of humor like that, are born sinful. Yeah? Bad. They're nasty children. Yeah. For the Romantics, children are born innocent. Children are born with a knowledge of God, or for the less Christian Romantics, children are born with a knowledge of the divine, of the spiritual. They come into the world from the spiritual world, and so they continue to have some of that divinity, some of that innocence. The world is corrupt and takes that innocence away from them, and they gain experience. That knowledge for somebody like Blake, and most of the Romantics, is about using experience, which is painful, but also reconnecting with the knowledge of innocence to reach a higher level of intelligence and of knowledge. So, adults know things that children don't because of experience. Because they have experience of the world, and that is painful, and that learning process is painful. But children know things that adults don't because they still have their innocence. So, if you can actually connect the two things, then you can go to higher knowledge. What is the title of this collection of poems? Not the animals. Nobody has prepared this class at all. How terribly sad. What is the title? What is the title of this collection of poems, please? Sorry? Infant Joy is the name of a poem. Infant Sorrow is the name of another poem. The Little Chimney Sweep is the name of another poem. The Lamb is the name of another poem. The Human Abstract is the name of another poem. Right, thank you. Not just Songs of Experience. The title of the full title of the poem is Songs of Innocence, of the collection of Songs of Innocence and Experience. And showing, we'll leave it at that for the moment. Songs of Innocence and Experience. And generally speaking, what we have is two poems, one from a point of view of innocence and one from a point of view of experience, reflecting similar subjects. So the example of that that you have in what we're studying is Infant Joy and Infant Sorrow. But you can listen to that on the previous recording, and it's all in the notes. So what is the parallel poem, the mirror poem to the tiger? Any idea? The Lamb. Good. The Lamb is innocent by stock simile, as innocent as a lamb. Yeah? A lamb is also innocent in that it is newly born. Yeah? A lamb is not, we're not talking about a sheep, we're talking about a lamb. And so that is the parallel text to this text about the tiger. And you can profitably have a look at the lamb and see what that says as well. It's also largely made up of questions. What else do you notice about this poem? What is suggested by AABB? What is suggested by the subject matter? And what is suggested by the lines? And what is suggested within the lines, and what is suggested by the first and last verse. Thank you. Okay, what would be the semantic field of that vocabulary? Dread is okay in the jungle, but it could be somewhere else. Fear, dare, what is the semantic field of that? What is the magic word for this course? What is the magic word for the sublime? The semantic field is sublimity. What can you tell me about the rhyme scheme AABB, about the lines, about the first verse and the last verse? There's questions throughout. There's all questions. What can you notice about the first verse and the last verse? And the last verse? What do I translate verse? What do I mean by verse? In Spanish, how do you say verse? Yeah, estrofa. Yeah, the only thing is estrofa, no verso. There's nothing else you have to say about the first verse and the last verse. Exactly the same? Yeah, one word has been changed. Can has been changed to dare. Okay, but that suggests... That suggests symmetry. Symmetry is a word that you will see in the first verse and is the last word in the poem. A-A-B-B suggests symmetry. The repetition of words suggests symmetry. What does symmetry make you think of? Yes. What other things are surprisingly symmetrical? Tigers! Tigers are symmetrical. Yeah? We have lines on tigers, symmetrical lines on tigers, A, A, B, B. Yeah? The tiger said that from one angle, it will have the same on either side. So the poem is reflecting an element of the tiger, and the poem has this idea of cyclicality with a certain amount of progression. The first verse is practically the same as the last verse, but we have gained one word's difference. Yeah? We have gained one piece of knowledge. But there is the idea here of circularity, like in one of these sonnet sequences where you go back to the beginning and you start again and you start thinking again. Okay, so it's the sort of thing that you might get in some sort of Buddhist incantation that makes you think. You are being provoked to think. Anything else that you notice about the words? Okay, there's quite a lot of euphony in terms of rhyme, alliteration, assonance, etc. That is typical of what type of context? Why do we tend to get texts which use quite a lot of abstract words and there's a lot of euphony? In religious poetry. In incantations, where the, again, this type of structure of trochaic tetrameters is typical of incantations. This is an incantation. This is trying to use words to cause something to appear. What it's causing to appear in this case is creative thought. But it's the same type of language that's used for invoking spirits. What else is special about the words? What's special about a word like dread or fearful? What does it translate for me, fearful? Temeroso? Any other meanings for fearful? I don't mean synonyms, I mean different meanings. What? Yes. It is a contradictonym. In English there are a series of words which mean two things which are the opposite, and you have to understand them from the context. So fearful can mean aterrador y terrifico. Dread can mean something that causes fear or receives fear. And there are a series of words, in other words, like cleave is a similar, or sanction, another word, another contradictonym. There are a series of words here which are contradictonyms, which normally you only are able to understand by their context, and here the context doesn't allow you to do that. So there are reverberations, and you understand the word by in a particular way, and that takes you off in a different direction. And if there is another reading of it, you can understand in a different way, and it takes you off in a different direction. What dread hands and what dread feet? You see that line? Can you see that line? What dread hand and what dread feet? Yes? Yes, Nick. Yes, good. Whose are the hands? Hands have to belong to somebody. Whose are the hands? God. Very possibly. You're assuming that God made the tiger. We didn't know that God made the tiger. The tiger could be made by Satan, could be made by somebody else, Urizen, Uriel, one of the different gods that, Blake talks about, but the creator, yeah? So what dread hands, what dread feet? Whose are the feet? The man. Probably the tigers. So having dread intentionally used in, we have this idea of a creator who is scared of his or her own creation. So what dread hands, manos mirosos, creando, yeah? What dread feet, las patas terrificas del tigre. But we have in the same sentence the same word used in a contradictory way. It's not, this is, this type of thing doesn't happen because he was a little bit drunk when he was writing the poem, or he wasn't very good at using language, or whatever. This is intentional stuff. Yeah. So what we have is a process by which he is using ambiguity to create resonance, so that you are projecting your own personal images from the language. We're not quite clear what is being created, really. That's a tiger. But is it a tiger? Why might it not be a tiger? What makes us think, oh, it isn't a tiger? Why do tigers have stripes? You see, this is where your class, your six-year-olds, will have this much more easily, will get the answer to this, than adults will. They have stripes to scare. No, they don't. Your six-year-old, ask your six-year-olds, why tigers have stripes? Yes? For camouflage, right. So, tigers have stripes because it helps them to camouflage in the intense jungle where they live. This tiger burns bright in the forest of the night. It would be completely against its interests as a predator to burn bright, to be able to be seen from a distance. Yes, you don't want to be able to. Doesn't want to be able to burn bright. It wants to be able to be camouflaged. I imagine if a tiger is hunting at night, you see nothing. Yeah, you don't see it burning bright in the forest. It doesn't contrast with the forest. It blends in with the forest. Yeah? Obviously, if you see it in the daytime, it's that beautiful orange and black color. Yeah? It's orange, black, and white. But at night, in the same way as todos los gatos son pardos por la noche, that reduces its form and it becomes completely invisible. And that's why they're good hunters. And anyway, he's saying to us with the second word, no, sorry, with the first word and the second word. Yeah? It's not tiger, T-I-G-E-R. Tiger, T I G E R. It's Tiger, capital T, Y. So it is in some way related to the tiger, but it is not a tiger, not any old tiger. Okay? There are other words which are crucial and which are intentionally ambiguous. Frame. What does frame mean? Okay? Yeah, but it's a verb here. Frame like perfect symmetry. Frame is a verb, yes? What does frame mean as a verb? Possibly. Possibly, more or less, yes. Yes, to shape, to mold. To constrain, to limit, very good. To imagine. To frame an idea is to imagine an idea. It can also mean to describe or to turn into a work of art. And might have something that can be determined to work well. There's only one meaning of frame which it does not mean. And that is, have you seen the film Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Yes? Kinninganya Roger Rabbit? Yeah. Right, well, Kinninganya Roger Rabbit is called Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And frame there is to create the situation where somebody seems to be guilty when they are not. How do you say that in Spanish? No, no, sentir culpable, para ser culpable. But there must be a word in Spanish, no? It's just... But it's more dejar evidencias, pruebas, para que la policía lo encuentra, para que este va a la cárcel. No? Right, right. That's what frame means there. That meaning was first recorded in 1912 and is in American English, we use the British English now. That is does not mean. So don't think who framed Roger Rabbit. It's making the tiger seem to be guilty when the tiger is not guilty, because that meaning it does not mean. We know that that meaning was not available to Blake. But there are all of the other meanings, the ideas of limiting, the ideas of creating. Now, a very, very basic idea of the Romantics is about the impossibility for the creator of really, truly describing what they have imagined. Okay? You have this wonderful idea for the neoclassicists. The neoclassicists basically say, we're very clever, we can describe anything, we can categorize anything, we can understand anything. Yeah? It's just a case of putting iambic pentameters and everybody's happy. The Gothic come along, and then everything's about psychology and fear and all this type of thing. The Romantics take that lesson and intellectualize it and are interested in the impossibility of expressing oneself fully. You have this idea in your head, and we've all had it, yeah? Like, you have this an image or a concept in your head, but we just do not have the talent to really put that into writing or into a picture. Yeah? We can think of this brilliant image, for example, but we can't quite do it. Rochester, who's Rochester? No. You've already started reading Jane Eyre, haven't you? Yes. So that is the only novel you have to read for the second part of the course. It is going to come up in the exam. It has to. Yes? So, Jane Eyre is hugely important. You have to know who Rochester is. Rochester says, and there's a huge amount of romanticism in Jane Eyre, it's not the thing. Jane is talking about her incapacity to draw what she imagined, and she says, it's not the thing. And he says, yes, it's not the thing, but it is the shadow of the thing. And so that is a very, very good example. And when you come to that piece, underline it, get ready to use it in your exam, because you can almost certainly use it somewhere. It's a bit like our hungry judges, yeah? You can slot that in somewhere and look really good because you're directly quoting from one of the texts. When you come to that point, quote that, because it is a very, very good example of romantic thinking, the fact that you cannot fully transpose what is in the mind into words or into pictures. Words fail you, pictures fail you, ultimately. So what is happening here is we're having a direct communication between Blake's imagination and your imagination. Blake is not having a fully formed image from the poem. The poem is there to stimulate your imagination. Again, it's not telling you what to think, it's provoking your thought process. Yeah? But another basic concept of the Romantics is that the creator has an element of the divine. The poet is godlike. The artist is godlike. So, maybe God, for those of them who were conventional Christians, some of them were, some of them weren't, is the ultimate creator. But the poet is a sort of mini version of God, because the poet and the artist creates where there is nothing. And so, when we ask who creates the tiger, it's not very clear if the tiger creates itself, if the tiger is created by some evil force, if the tiger is created by God, or if the tiger is created by the creator as a stand-in for the poet. The poet is creating the tiger. Blake is therefore the creator. And of course, Blake is the creator of the poem, The Tiger. Whether he is the creator of the tiger in the poem of the tiger is another question. So, we have this idea. What is special about a tiger? Why a tiger and not a Jack Russell Terrier? Why a tiger and not a horse? Horses are nice. Why a tiger and not my cat? Right. We are talking about the end of the 18th century. How many animals are left that actually kill human beings easily? Polar bears and tigers. Lions can do, but they don't choose to normally. And hyenas can, but you'd have to be in a pretty bad state. Hyenas don't normally. Very, very few animals we are seen as prey at the end of the 18th century, in the early part of the 21st century. That is not our natural state. Where do I say that? There's nothing natural about that. The fact that we have killed off all the wolves and most of the grizzly bears and most of the polar bears, and the last ones are going with Donald Trump's name written on their minds, and the tiger, there's about four tigers left, and there's, did you hear what happened yesterday? There's about four Sumatran tigers left, and they put a Sumatran male with a Sumatran female to try and get them to reproduce, and the male killed the female. So, disaster. Anyway, when you've got about four individuals left of a subspecies, that subspecies is gone because there's not enough genetic material. It's a bit of a waste of time, honestly. But anyway, that is where we are. Have you heard of Dinofelis? Dinofelis. Sounds like a Greek pop singer, but it's not a Greek singer. Dinofelis, between about 1 million and 2 million years ago, there was one of the large cats was specialized in eating hominids. hominins, as this probably this is a, so the modern terminology is hominin, not hominid. There was a big cat that was specialized in eating us. Our fear, our sublimity, our reaction of dread, of being impressed by and terrified by things like tigers and lions, comes from our experience, our cultural experience with Deinotheles, yeah? With an animal that is specialized in eating human beings. It's a little bit like Diogenes the Sublist, but Diogenes the Sublist was much more interested in things like horses and stuff like that, because the whole thing is about sticking those big teeth into the jugular. Deinotheles was just a very, very big, stocky lion-type situation. And in fact, have you seen that film with... God knows who it is. I was going to say Pierce Thingamy, but I'm not sure. There's a film possibly with Michael Douglas, possibly, about two white hunters in Africa, with some lions that have been killing people, and they go out to try and kill these lions. There is the idea, and it's controversial, but that there was some residual element of Deinotheles in these two or three lions in the 1880s, which were around in the north of South Africa, which were killing the workers on the railway lines. And they were taking their bodies back to caves, which is a typical behavior of Deinotheles, and is very scary. I mean, lions don't live in caves. And there were these huge, great big lions, far bigger than normal lions, that were specialized in killing human beings. And so they think that there might have been some sort of mixture, these two. I mean, they got killed before they could be genetically analyzed, etc., etc., etc. But there is some possibility that even into more or less modern times, there was some genetic survival of Deinotheles. It doesn't really matter. Our fear of the dark comes from our relationship with caves and the fact that these types of big cats lived in caves, and these animals were specialized in killing us or our ancestors. And this is part of genetic heredity. And the obvious consequence of that in Blake's time was tigers. Why? Are there a lot of tigers in Peking Rye? Do you think there are a lot of tigers in London? Yes or no? Correct. No. Right. So, what is he talking about? Why is he, I mean, there are polar bears closer. Why is he talking about tigers? Why not polar bear in the ice sheets of the Arctic? India. Yes, thank you. India. Colonies. The Raj. India. One of the ways in which lots of colonists were dying, I mean, most of them were dying of cholera and tropical diseases, but they were regularly dying because it was sort of the equivalent of San Fermines, came out of soy, I'm going to go and kill a tiger. But it's actually, tigers are very intelligent animals, and they were taking out quite a lot of idiotic British colonial people who were going into the jungle to catch the tiger. Yeah. So this is actually something that is being regularly reported at the time. Yeah? You will see in the tutorial notes there is an organ from the Victorian Albert Museum, made probably about 1801. I think it's not quite sure when it was made, by Indians, not by the British, but it's an organ, type of organ you play, of a colonial soldier, a soldier from the East Indian Company, being eaten by a tiger, being killed by a tiger. It's a little bit of revenge, if you like, this organ, but it was brought back from India and is in the Victorian Albert Museum. You can still see it today. It opens up and you can play it. But that is something that people is happening to people at the time. I suppose it's a little bit sort of, you know, it might be that sort of the way that idiotic people get killed, like balconying or taking selfies on big buildings or something like that. Yeah? This is the way that idiotic young people who want to show how brave they are getting killed at this time. And we have a problem of theodicy. What is theodicy? Theodicy. You should teach your children about theodicy, very important. Theodicy is the fundamental problem of Christianity. How can there be evil in the world when you have a God who is omnipotent, omniscient? Theodicy? Omnipotent, omniscient. Well, God supposedly knows everything, is all-powerful, is in charge, yes? And yet you have evil in the world. How is that possible? How can there be a world in which there is something like a tiger that can kill people? If nature is all this happy flower thing, yeah, we've now got it all under control, how can you have something like a tiger? How can evil exist in the world? That is one of the questions that's being asked. Not answered, asked. So, rationalism, modernity, is all about control and is all about creating order, etc. But the imagination is like a tiger in the sense that it is something which is still outside human control. You cannot have a tiger as a pet. All sorts of idiots in Hollywood think you can have a tiger as a pet, but you can't have a tiger as a pet. Sorry? Yeah, exactly, yes. Well, I mean, sometimes it's very sad because you have proper nature reserves and things, and I think last month, a 22-year-old helper feeder was just eaten. She was half eaten by the time they got to her in America. But there are now more tigers, I think, in captivity in America than there are in the world, in out in nature. Terrible. But there is that thing that the imagination is this force which is out of control, and that idea, you have the idea from Pope that imagination, if it's under control, is very nice. You have the imagination, and then you have the steering wheel, which is reason. The Romantics are much more about, no, get rid of all of that, let the imagination go free. Then we can actually reach the sublime. Okay? There's a fundamentally different view of how these two things interact. We talk about somebody smiling. What does it say about smile? Did he smile his work to see? Did he smile his work to see, I think? I haven't got the poem here, but did he smile his work to see? And the obvious conclusion syntactically about that is that we're talking about the creator. However, have any of you got the picture? Have you got the poem with the picture? Anybody? No? Well, if you have to look up the poem with the picture, you'll see in many of the pictures, the tiger is smiling. Which again, makes it, confuses the issue about who is the creator, who is creating, who is created. Do we have a situation where the tiger creates itself in some sort of way? Ultimately, for Christians, presumably, God just created himself. God just, I'm going to create myself. Yeah? There's no, you can't have a situation where there was a pre-God who created God. Because that doesn't serve anything, because you just need a pre-God to create the pre-God. So ultimately you have to have a situation where the creator is the creator. Yeah? Another basic problem of religion. So, you have this idea of the visionary, the poet, the visionary, the semi-divine creator. creating something, using his imagination, which is at the same time terrifying for him, himself, in what he was creating. His capacity to imagine beyond reason is potentially terrifying. We have other phrases which will cause ambiguity and cause problems. Did the stars throw down their spears? Put them there. Did the stars throw down their spears? What does it say? What? When the stars come in? He who made the lamb make thee. Yeah. Okay, so what does that mean when the stars threw down their spears? Quite possibly. But it sounds like an act of aggression, yes? The stars threw down their spears, throwing down their spears at the tiger. But we have a problem that in The Four Zoas, which is another poem by Blake, he says, the stars threw down their spears and fled naked away. The throw down as in tirar ir por patas. Yeah? So we have the ambiguity there of whether the stars are competing with the tiger or whether they are terrified by the tiger and giving up completely. How is the tiger in our world, in our conception of the thing, in this poem, greater than the star? Describe a star. Describe a star. Come on, describe a star. It doesn't move, okay. Right. So we have tiger, tiger burning bright in the forest of the night. Compared to the stars, yes, they're observing, right? But if the tiger's burning bright, burning. It's not cold light, it's not, you can't touch it like this white light. It's burning. And the stars? For you, for us today, of course, there's thermonuclear reactions happening and it's all incredibly hot and thousands of degrees, etc. But we're in the late 18th century. Stars are cold. Stars are not like the sun. They don't produce light. The tiger burns at night. They don't. The tiger is more powerful than the star. So in that sense, they can't compete with him. So, very good. Presumably, the tiger is a metaphor for something. What could the tiger be a metaphor for? We said the tiger poem could be a metaphor for the imagination of the poet. Okay? Anything else? The tiger could be a metaphor for the center of the universe. Good, okay, possible. I don't know why. What do we know about the tiger? What do we know about the tiger? What do we know about this tiger, not the tigers in general? How is the tiger created? We have chains, and we have anvils, and we have fire. Where do we have, what's an anvil? Or Fernando? No? Anybody know what Fernando is? Junco, I think. Junco, right. Junco, right. Chains. Fire. What are we talking about? What's the context? Metallurgy, right. We're talking about a blacksmith. Yeah? Or whatever you call it. Okay. So, this tiger is being produced by industrial processes. So one word, no, it's not, this is just one out of about 20 interpretations. There's not one correct interpretation. You can have a little but you can't have an because there's no Right. The tiger is being, could represent the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution represents what? What happens in the Industrial Revolution? Well, chain production comes with Ford in the early 20th century. Urban development, partly, yes. Factories, yes. What do factories mean? What are the two aspects of factories which are sociologically important? Okay, so you have the dual process of putting a lot of workers together in the same place with a common interest, and working becomes Arbeiten. Anybody speak German? Well, there is a difference in German and potentially in English, and there should be in Spanish, between work and toil. Yeah. But it's hard, repetitive, mindless, soul-destroy. So, if you are an artisan, now, you may be an artisan in Valencia where you are paid 70 centimos per zapato. What world are we living in? But at least you are creating something. You are in touch with the product that you are creating. Marxism, which comes out of Romanticism, Marxism talks about alienation. You are no longer directly in contact with the product that you're creating. You're just a little part in the process. So you are no longer a creator, you're just a machine. Which is why, of course, it's so easy for the machines to replace us. Because we've created the ideal circumstance to replace human beings with machines, because that repetitive side is much more important than the creative side. So, capitalism creates a situation where it is planting the seeds of its own destruction. You have people being given mindless work and being put into contact with all sorts of other people who are doing mindless work and are therefore given power. Yeah? If you are just creating shoes at home in Valencia for 80 centimos per shoe, then you are atomized. But if you're doing it in a factory, you can strike, you have industrial power. So the tiger can represent the same sort of thing that Mary Wollstonecraft is talking about when she talks about a blind elephant which lashes out. This is the working class can be destructive, but it's not their fault. It's the fault of capitalism, which creates new conditions without the Enlightenment to pass on the benefit, share the benefits of those new conditions. We also have situations where the French revolutionaries were regularly compared to tigers. One person talked about the French revolutionaries being, to expect democracy from the French Revolution was like expecting democracy from a parliament of tigers in the jungle in Africa. But that's what they said. They've confused Africa and India. But anyway, there is this idea of revolution as being this violent force that is destructive, that is also beautiful, because what they are destroying is the ancient world, which is detestable. So it is very much like Frankenstein's monster, if you like. There's also very much the idea at this time, typically, Wright of Derby, John Wright of Derby, one of the great painters of the early Industrial Revolution. No, I'm getting confused. Sorry, no, I'm thinking Fuseli. Oh God, no, I'm getting confused. I'm getting more confused now. Anyway, there's a lot of paintings at this time of tigers, and especially lions, attacking horses, jumping on the backs of horses, etc. And there's very much this idea from Gulliver's Travels onwards of horses being these rational beings. And so you have these animals that represent energy attacking rationalism. And the the revolutionary tigers. George Stubbs is the painter I was thinking of, who's doing these paintings of lions attacking tigers. So you have, again, this leads into the idea of the Marxist ideas of philosophers have only interpreted the world, our job is to change it, etc., etc. And Blake later wrote, the tigers of wrath, los tigres de la ira, are wiser, so más sabios, than the horses of instruction. So there's this idea of horses representing the ordered bourgeois society and tigers representing the energy of the working class. And it's anachronistic, but at the time of the Easter Rising, when the Irish tried to have a revolution against the British during the First World War in 1816, Yeats wrote, "A terrible beauty is born." That, I mean, that was the rebellion was destroyed, but that process of rebellion gave birth to this destructive force that was going to be unstoppable. That idea of terrible beauty is absolutely the sublime and is very much in tune with these ideas. Obviously, Blake wasn't influenced by Yeats, because Yeats is much later. So there's all these ideas of sublimity. 1 minute, and I will give you one more idea. We have at the same time a very interesting guy who you can look into called one of the things that has been ignored quite a lot until quite recently is the influence of Indian ideas on British culture around this time. You have obviously British culture having a huge influence on India, but all sorts of things get brought back, and there's quite a lot of translations of Indian religions and things like this. And the 1785, we have a translation of the Bhagavad Gita, and we know that Blake's friends Fuseli and Johnson were reading this at the time. So we can see possibly the tiger as a symbol of Shiva. What do we know about Shiva? Yeah, but it's the god of creation, purification and destruction. Okay? Very outside the Western concept that you have the same god of creation and destruction. But those are the three aspects of creation, purification, and destruction. And of course, that you could link back to the working class. The working class creates, they're the only class that creates, the only class that actually produces, but they're also purifying by destroying the old order, the old society in the French Revolution. And of course, Blake, in the first instance, was very much in favour of the French Revolution, which was going on at this time. But there is another place where the English are fighting at this time is against a guy called Tipu Sultan. Now, Tipu Sultan was a Hindu leader, was a Muslim leader against the British, and was quite successful for some time. He was enlightened was quite democratic in some of his policies. But he was also one of the first people to use rockets in military warfare. We have the idea that the West is always much more advanced. But even before the Russians were using rockets in Stalingrad and in the Second World War, this guy was actually the first guy to use rockets. I think more for psychological effect than for the actual destructive effect, but was using them against the British at this time. Again, possibly the stars throwing down their spears could be a relation to that. The tiger in the Victoria and Albert Museum is called Tipu's Tiger. It was created for him. Now, around the time that the tiger was actually being written, Tipu was defeated by a British general called Munro, as in Marilyn Munro, a British general called Munro. But his nickname, the nickname of Tipu, was the Tiger of Mysore. And Mysore is a place in India. Mysore. It was Tigre de Mysore. Sounds like the Missouri, very well. But interestingly, more or less at the same time as Munro was defeating Tipu, Munro's son was killed by a tiger. So it's perfectly possible that the whole thing is inspired by this Indian context. Certainly, there are probably ideas knocking around in the background about it, whether it's specifically about Tipu, etc., etc. And we can go on. There are other interpretations. You'll see there are. Well, I haven't actually covered everything that's in the tutorial notes. You can enjoy those for yourself. But this is an incredibly resonant poem in the sense of the amount of ideas and what it can produce, and it's one of these works of literature that the more you read it, every time you read it, you can get something else out of it. So do enjoy it. I haven't not looked at Infant Joy and Infant Sorrow because there's not lots of stuff to see there. Blake is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, really, really, really great poet. So do explore Blake on your own as well. Bye bye. Any questions? Next week we will look at The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Coleridge. Coleridge, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, is it? Bien, pues nada, nos vamos.